Hello and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name is Daniel Johansson.
And I'm Maureen Smith.
And we are joined today by Pamela Torrey and Matthew Peckham of the Chicago Vocal Arts Consortium.
Hello.
Yes, it's good to be here.
Welcome. How are you guys doing today? You all.
We're doing well. I have... Oh, hello, Moody. I am in the process of dealing with some really fun back pain while singing and producing and running a summer program.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
No, when it comes in waves.
Just right there, you know?
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah, it all just happens at once.
Oh, God. Moody's going to knock over the printer.
Yes, that.
Cool.
She really does. She knows now when we're recording.
Yeah.
She knows when we're recording.
No, and it's immediately we were talking about that before we started recording that Moody is the like the weird welcoming party of our guests, and it's always the worst when someone's allergic too, because then especially if we don't know that they're allergic until she's already in their lap and they're like, I'm allergic.
We had someone on and we were like about to hit record and the cats were just like, hey everybody, and that person was like, I'm really sorry. Can the cats go away? I'm allergic. And we were like, oh, God. Oh, I'm so sorry. Yes, absolutely. Uh-huh. Yeah. I'm really sorry.
And they were like, let me vacuum the air.
And we also have, like, house Benadryl now for people that come that are allergic. We want to get, like, Zyrtec or something that
is. We have Zyrtec.
I thought I bought Zyrtec.
Yeah. It's in the kitchen.
Perfect. Anyway, so this
exactly
is like
where that belongs.
That's exactly where it should be.
You know, you cook with it. Yeah. It's a little sour.
Yeah.
Just grind it up, put it in your martini.
It's like salt.
Right.
Yeah.
So I know that this has been like the most relevant conversation to what you guys are up to right now.
I mean, do what you gotta do.
But, so, you all actually have a couple things going on that we want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So how about first, let's talk about the project that you're all in the middle of right now, which is Little Women.
Yeah,
I know that we talked a little bit about it because Matt was on the show in the past, and so now I'm also glad that Pam's
here. What point were we in the process the last time that I came
last
to talk
time,
about
we
it?
We hadn't
Fuck
started it yet.
Surely we hadn't
were,
started. Yeah.
We were several weeks before, and at that point, I remember very clearly where we were because I was lying in the corner in the fetal position, panicking over writing schedules.
Yeah,
And like begging people to please give me their availability,
and
like,
I was
crying.
Here.
Yeah,
yeah.
I was. I think I was
eating
in the shower.
ZD.
I'm 90% sure I was in the shower crying when I was listening to that episode because I was like, I have to do schedules and no one's giving availability.
Anyways, I think in that episode we talked about the concept of it.
Yes.
Of CVAC.
It was
and we
a dark
talked
time.
About
the concept of the project too.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were talking about like figuring out some last minute casting things too.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, we have a cast.
Yeah.
Snaps for that. Currently, we're about to enter our second week of staging rehearsals.
Okay.
We have our last rehearsal of our first week tomorrow, and then Monday we start staging Act 2. So Act 1 is completely staged.
Mm-hmm.
We have coached the entire opera with the wonderful Beth Parker.
Oh,
yeah.
And the entire cast has worked with her, and it was a joy. And now we are staging with Rose Freeman as our director, Jordan Kreis as our pianist, and Kathy O'Shaughnessy as our conductor.
Mm-hmm.
Dream team.
Yes.
Really,
all
though.
Female power.
And
Matt.
That's the move.
I don't know.
And Matt.
What, were you actively seeking out women? Because I just thought
I didn't
that
tell
they
you that.
Were
I
literally
was.
The best people who were available.
Yeah. It's nice when that works out that way.
Yes. I also actively went after an entirely female creative team.
Yeah. Which is, I think, the move.
And Matt.
And Matt.
I was already there, just along for the ride.
We adopted him.
Well, we had that conversation yesterday with Sam, where we were talking about, you know, I think that diversity is very much in the communicative ether right
the
now.
The zeitgeist.
The zeitgeist, that's the word I was looking for. And kind of figuring out how to do that. And
about fucking time, diversity is in the zeitgeist.
I know, and it's... For some reason, I feel like whenever I'm talking to white straight men about producing things, it's like a shock when I say to them, like, you could also hire a consultant from that community or from that minority. And then it's like, oh. And it's like, well, you know, you're doing Porky and Bess. You should probably ask a black person.
And then it turns into gotcha journalism unintentionally.
Yeah.
It's like, no, just be not a bad person.
But it's so easy.
Right.
It's so easy to get us.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
You're so easily caught.
You can't just like, you can't have a conversation without a gotcha
Real
moment.
Man.
Right.
Real man.
Yeah. So anyway.
Yes.
Gotcha. You're white.
But I think that
House is holding room of white people.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Talks.
Well, that was the thing I think we were talking about though, is that the idea of doing something with all within it, what you would, I guess you could call an oppressed community, all doing it, doing all women, for example, that is a radical idea, but it maybe necessarily shouldn't be, not necessarily, it shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. Like, no. The idea of doing an opera called Little Women.
I don't think it's necessarily radical. I think it's definitely a novelty and a conscious choice you have to make.
Right.
Well, something, a comment that I heard really early on in this process from one of our faculty was that, you know, she was like, oh, no, it's not surprising that all the people you found were women. She's like, women have been running opera for years, mm-hmm. you know, in all the positions
especially
where things
on
get
the local
done.
Level.
Right.
Just not necessarily front and center mm-hmm. in the big positions of power. Mm-hmm. So
it's very true. And when we were looking at what opera to do, I mean, we settled on Little Women very early in this process because we knew it's, you know, the most commonly done 20th century opera in the United States. It has a ton of female roles and our membership base is majority female. So we needed to make sure we were catering to them. But when in my brain, when I was thinking about the piece, it's written by one of the first commercially successful female authors in the American canon. Mm. I mean, I'm going to get super nerdy on you and get all transcendental.
Go in.
Go.
But Louise May Alcott was raised unconventionally, didn't wear a corset, was essentially left to her own devices for much of her childhood, and had a mad crush on Thoreau and Emerson in various different ways. Wrote an entire book. Creepy book called Moods about it, in case you're looking for a really bizarre read. It's a really weird book. And she wrote like trashy gothic fiction to pay the bills. And this was a piece that, you know, she didn't think was going to make any money. She only wrote it because her father basically pressured her into doing it so his book would get published. And he did. The publisher was like, I'll publish your book if she writes me a piece for like a book for girls. Which is what ended up happening. Bronson was having a complex, and he's like, I want my book published. Yeah. Write something. Mm-hmm. Do it now. And so she did, and it was an enormous success, and she became, like, the female author of the American lexicon and came out of this really unconventional culture. But then the opera was adapted by a man. The libretto was adapted by Mark Adamo, and so was the music, and the music was mm-hmm. written by him. So it's this very female perspective mm-hmm. filtered through a gay man. And
where do you see that, since you're so familiar with, like,
I see it very much in the way that John Brooke is set. Very much. Because I have him singing at me all the time. I'm playing Meg. And he's telling me he loves to teach and it's easier than training a cult. And I'm just like, dude,
yeah.
Check your privilege. And I see it also in Act One Laurie. Because Act One Laurie is kind of a douchebag.
Is that different than how they are portrayed in the books?
Yeah. Laurie in the book is very much just like trying to become Joe. He's just like, he wants to be, he and Joe, like when he calls her his doppelganger in the opera, I think that's very accurate.
Mm-hmm.
That he is like the other side of her.
Mm-hmm.
And like personality wise. But mm-hmm. this opera, there are some just weird moments of patriarchy like shoved into this feminist piece.
That's so interesting. And I'm really.
We need women. We need women to check it, Dan.
Yeah.
I thought about a female team.
Thank you.
I got you. I've known this guy a long time.
Yeah.
You know, we needed a female team, and I specifically wanted Rose because I know that this is not her favorite piece. And that
right.
she wasn't
we kind
going...
of sought her out because she's been known to say how much she hates this opera.
She's been known to say it. And I wanted somebody who wasn't going to baby it and who wasn't going to...
Like masturbate all over it.
Yeah,
right.
Who wasn't going to like, you know, just go hog wild with sentimentality. Somebody who was going to sit there and say, no, these are real people and let's treat them like women. Let's not treat them like, you know, some kind of fetishized girl.
Rose
I fucking
Freeman.
Love that.
Rose Freeman is one of my...
She's a boss bitch. I love her.
Yeah.
Love her.
I adore every second I spend with her.
We've had her on a couple times, and it's the best.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Even, she was in a bad mood for one of them. She was, like, going through cigarette withdrawals or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
And she was a delight.
She's smoking again. She's great.
Yeah, it's fine. We're having a wonderful time.
She's great. She's smoking again.
Thank
Life
God.
Is grand.
She... Well, she was like day three, and she was leaving for Mexico in the morning to go on her honeymoon. And she was like, she was sitting
she
in
herself on her honeymoon.
Yeah, she was sitting in the our throne. Yeah. She was sitting in our throne, just like legs crossed. She came in and she was like, "Throne's mine," and she just like, and she was just like sitting there, like legs crossed, just like this.
Again, more reasons why I adore this woman.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. The other day in rehearsal, she's like, "Over here, it just smells like cigarettes and lesbianism," and I was like, it "smells like home." For those of you who do not know, I have a lesbian mother and was raised in the LGBT community in Rochester, nice. New York. Mm-hmm. So. Kind of like grew up around craziness, and
so you're like,
I was like, yes, breathe it in, breathe it in. Let me inhale the aroma. But yeah, when we, anywho, back to where we were,
you know,
having this essentially feminist piece of literature where Louise May Alcott never wanted Joe to end up with Laurie, and really she didn't want Joe to marry anybody. Mm. She wanted Joe to end up alone, like as a literary spinster. If you read her diaries and her writing, that's what her goal was.
Mm.
And so when you have that filtered through a male perspective, I thought we needed to filter the man back out.
That's awesome. It was. I'm actually really glad that you said all that, because you basically answered my question that I wanted to ask, and then some. So
so thanks for coming on.
Yeah. No, well...
that's the show.
And kind of my next thought is I'm curious if you think that that pattern of things that are female literature, female-based authors and the like, being filtered through a male lens, if there is a pattern of that in classical music or not.
It happens all the time. Constantly. Fanny Mendelssohn, I think, is probably the best example of it, where she was writing prolifically and was just producing hordes of song literature and piano literature when she was a teenager and in her 20s. She couldn't publish anything, so it all ended up getting filtered through her brother, and he published a whole slew of her songs under his name, which weren't discovered to be hers until later, and everybody reads them with, you know, they see his name on them, and so they read them as being from him, and they don't realize, A, some of the poets are female.
Yeah.
They don't bother to read the name of the poet, and secondly, that these pieces are, if you listen to them from a feminist perspective, there's a lot of like weird subversive harmonies happening. There's one song called The Nun where she's using all this like weird, you know, chromaticism. It's super minor and dark, and everybody's like, "Oh, Felix is really in his prime here. He's expressing, you know, his pathos
his
and
manly
some other
sadness.
Some other crap like that." It was written by his sister, who was fucking talented. And, you know, shit like that happened all the time, and it's going to take us, you know, another 100 years to get out from underneath that.
And I would say probably that a lot of this, the work that's done by women in this industry because of all the men at the top of the power structure gets filtered through a male perspective before it reaches its final form.
At some point, some man's got his hands all over it, whether he's the director, conductor, general manager of the company, artistic director, producer. He's all over it, and his opinion will end up being in there somewhere, which, you know, it's not always a bad thing.
Yeah, I mean, multiple opinions are generally
great,
good.
But if you've got essentially a work that was written by a woman for women... Mm-hmm. And then it's being filtered through 5 or 6 men before it gets back to being a story about women.
Yeah. Well, and then when you look at it from the other way, like, there are entire pieces of art where a woman never touches it.
Right.
And, like, at no part of the process.
Even on stage. There are pieces that, like, Janáček's from the House of the Dead is all men. Written by man, all about men. Men on stage, no women.
Right,
Billy Budd.
Right,
Billy Budd.
And if you want to have it the other way, it seemed extreme. I think.
Yeah,
people. If you want to have it all women, it's that I do think that
you have to like make a conscious effort, and even then, like, you know, we inevitably some, you know, male violinist is going to get involved and.
Eventually there will be men involved. I mean, in Little Women itself, there are male characters.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
We do have, and we have an incredible cast with some really wonderful guys in it. You know, Matt is our Laurie. You know, our male cast members are fantastic.
Right.
But they fit into this overall, like, feminist narrative where the biggest relationships in this opera have nothing to do with the men.
Right. Yeah, we kind of, like, appear as, like, love interests, and then it's more about the sisters' relationships with each other.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I wanted to tag on to the point about you having to make an effort to create, like, a show where it's all women on stage is that I think the history of Western storytelling is also very male-centric.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have a wealth of stories to draw on where all the main characters are women, whereas you do with men.
There is a lot of literature, though. Like the Bronson sisters.
Bronte, sorry. Jane Eyre is my favorite book.
Yeah, no, I like knew as I said that. I was like, Pam's going to correct me on that.
I got you, Bill.
I
mean, the Bronte sisters, stuff, Jane Austen, but Jane Austen gets cited a lot, but her books don't have inherent drama, so they don't make good operas, because everything's happening in a very stylized manner. The Bronte sisters' work does make good opera, but Wuthering Heights, I think, is the only one that's, like, Jane Eyre's been adapted, but not well.
Mm-hmm.
Wuthering Heights is the only one that's, like, famous, but the book itself has narrative issues.
Well, like, who wrote Roman Fever?
It was Robert Ward.
The book.
Edith What's-Her-Face.
Edith Wharton.
But the librettist was Roger Brunyet.
And then the opera was written by Robert Ward.
Perfect example. That's the thing that I think is amazing, too, because you have a wealth of, like...
Roman Fever, Roger Brunyet, little sidetrack. He was the director of my undergrad opera program.
Nice.
Oh.
Thoroughly unpleasant man.
Well, this opera was mildly unpleasant to have to learn. So, because for those of you who don't know, Dan and I did it in grad school together, and we had a marvelous time.
Awesome plot. Really cool plot.
Really cool plot.
How's the libretto?
I mean, the libretto...
I just don't like him.
Yeah.
It had some really weird tangents thrown into it, and like fleshed out a lot of stuff that just doesn't... I mean, the story's 4 pages
long. That whole airplane song, you know what I'm talking about?
The sisters,
like,
right.
We get it. You're whimsical. All
right. You like to tap dance. Life is great. Get it back to my song.
Right. Yeah, no, Pam played one of the mothers, and...
Well, your character had all of the...
I had all the power.
Yeah.
It was great.
You got to play the cool role.
Yeah,
That's
I got to play the... Except I didn't get an aria, which I thought was totally fucking lame.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I have all the power in this opera, and you don't give me an aria?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like Rose has been saying, the person with the most power typically...
Talks
the least, does the least.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I think this conversation kind of sets up our next conversation really well, in that what I think is really powerful about CVAC is that you all have this freedom to do things, maybe we can call it the right way. You know, doing things.
Or, you know, a better way.
And it's not necessarily the right way or a better way, but it's the way that the community needs it.
Mm-hmm. At worst, a different way. At best, I think the right way. I think that in a lot of ways that there are sacrifices in that. And there are things that are more made difficult in the stage where you all are in now. And so just kind of the thing that I know that we also really want to talk about is the idea of fundraising, is the idea of being a fledgling nonprofit, because I know that's where you all are moving towards.
Mm-hmm.
I already lost the other nugget of thing that I wanted to talk about, and I already...
Well, there's a lot there.
Yeah, there's a lot there. We can unpack that if you'd like to.
Yeah, I'll remember. So let's go first with talking about... I just remember what it was. Basically, I would love to... Let's talk about the Indiegogo campaign first.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Sure. Where to begin?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we kind of have to roll back to our founding in order to get to the why we're doing the Indiegogo campaign.
Right, okay.
So, 2 years ago... About a little over 2 years ago, when we came up with this idea, we had initially wanted to go nonprofit right away.
Right.
And then my role within the organization is I'm the director of operations and finances. So I started doing some research and figured out that financially we just couldn't afford it. The cost to hire a lawyer to go over the documents, which I know there's the lawyers for the arts group and such, but just to be able to get the paperwork set up, to be able to deal with the new banking structure behind being a nonprofit. There are a lot of moving parts, and we were not capable of handling that at the time. And of putting the money in.
It wasn't worth it because, we had to start small.
Yeah, we couldn't afford to put the money in to become a nonprofit. And we also didn't have the network to create a board. Because you need to have a board of directors who buy in order to be part of your nonprofit. And we had a few people that we were interested in, but none of them were interested in us because we didn't have a real business yet. So we decided to register instead as a general partnership and work as a for-profit entity for a few years.
And just make no profit.
And just make no money. But it made doing the taxes a lot easier. So I actually can do our taxes without having to hire somebody. I've been able to do them 2 years in a row.
Awesome. Yeah.
Our banking's a lot simpler. Just there are a lot of things that are quite a bit easier by not being a nonprofit when you're a really small organization. But now as we're expanding and we're taking on larger projects like Little Women, for example, and the various language workshops we've run, the series of classes that our members have been asking for, we need a little bit more support. And so that's why we're looking to make the transition into nonprofit status. And that's where our Indiegogo comes in.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we're becoming big enough that... We just, our budget needs to increase.
Right.
Pam and I have been managing the whole organization ourselves this whole time, which is fine, but now that, originally we were running one or two events per month. Now we're running consistently four to six events per month, plus some of these big projects like Little Women. And the day-to-day management is just too much for us to do in our free time.
Right.
So we need to expand, the inner workings of the organization. And pretty much that means we need to hire an administrator.
Yeah.
But to do that, we need also to have some more income from somewhere. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because right now, people are paying to take the classes.
They are.
They're cheap because of the way that we have structured them, where we're coaching in groups, or we get, we're not paying room fees, or we have other, various things that we've been able to finagle.
It's your classic Michael Scott paper company.
Thanks for that.
Yes.
We've really been able to keep the costs low, but with the way that we operate, we run our classes essentially at cost with a small overhead to cover our liability insurance and, in theory, pay ourselves. Mm-hmm. I say in theory because something always happens.
Of course.
Yeah, people don't show up or payment doesn't go through or someone has an extenuating circumstance and you have to refund them. So the money goes away. Yeah. So setting ourselves up to with a profit margin of 25-ish percent actually
we end up coming out at cost.
Even. Pretty consistently. So we could fold the costs of making a point of paying an administrator into what we're charging singers,
but that is
directly counter to our mission.
Completely contrary to everything that we do, and also we wouldn't be able to run anything because no one would be able to afford it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We'd be shooting ourselves in the foot.
Exactly. Yeah. But once we go nonprofit, we're going to be eligible for a whole lot of other things. Mm-hmm. And when I look at the budget that other arts organizations have from donors in this city, if we had $10,000 a year?
If I had $10,000 a year, I could build an empire.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's what I'm hoping is going to attract donors to us, is A, the fact that when we have money, it goes a long way.
Mm-hmm.
And B, the fact that there is no organization that is doing what we're doing right now and that has such a breadth of impact as what we're doing.
There's from what we have gathered just from our network, there's no one in the country doing what we're doing.
Yeah, which is helping singers who have just kind of been kicked out of the nest and are suddenly saddled with debt and day jobs
yes.
and
all of the
a
above.
Lack of connections.
Moving to a new city. Or if you're in the situation like I am, where I just came off of, you know, pretty significant vocal shift and surgical things, and I had my tonsils removed, yay. But I had to take lessons basically weekly for 3 months to just learn how to use my voice. And by the time I was done paying for that, it was like, coachings? What are those? I can't afford that.
You have to pay for everything, and the work that you accept... Good work that is good for your career can maybe pay you $200 for 6 solid weeks of work.
Which is like tons.
And so a lot of people who deserve to participate in this industry and who have really important things to say because they come from different perspectives just run out of resources. And it just hurts to see that happen.
It makes me want to scream on a daily basis.
And the people who come and participate in things with us, now that we've been around for a year and a half of running things, people have used our resources, like our audition prep classes.
Our audition list.
The audition lists and vocal arts database and all the different opportunities to coach cheaply. Those people now are going to Siegel Music Colony, going to Marilla, part of the Lyric Opera Chorus, part of the CSO Chorus, auditioning successfully for grad schools. And that is what I think is so critical about an organization like this, is that what we do supports everything that is vocal arts related in Chicago. And the more people we can serve, the more, you know, we can serve those organizations.
Yeah.
And that is what
we're
think
giving this city
is a, our that's our pitch.
We're giving the city a base of singers who are they're already enormously talented. They don't need help in that respect. They need is access to more training.
You're equipping them.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think also once people learn that this is a good city to be a singer in, then we're just more and more of the best talent is going to come here. And that's also good for our arts organizations.
Well, this is a really interesting time to bring up something that I've been thinking about a lot over the last few months. Started from my
that's
idea.
That's a part of our Little
Spurned.
Women. Not spurned. Anyway, right. Sorry.
No, no,
hashtag
you're fine.
Little Women.
Yeah.
We're at that point in the process.
Well, it started with working with Opera on Tap for as long as I did, in that you are putting on productions and putting on performances and stuff, and you're just hoping to kind of break even. Mm-hmm. And what I learned, I think the biggest lesson I learned from 3 years of doing that, is that the people that are attending stuff in Chicago are mostly low-income artists.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that you, if you are an arts organization and you're putting on performances that have a steep ticket price, or I'm not gonna get into any more two more specifics of like things that are shitty, but like
that is a very long conversation.
I mean, we could keep going,
though. He could.
Let's do a second podcast just about that.
But I think considering the very unique Chicago audience is really crucial for arts organizations in Chicago. And so, since you all have been doing this for a year and a half now. And you have so much experience with the audience. I'm just kind of curious on your general thoughts about that, about things that arts organizations should and shouldn't be doing when programming. I don't necessarily want.
Don't
that you guys
spend
are like,
your endowment to do anything. If you have an endowment, leave it alone. If you have a like major source of funding, don't touch it. That's first thing they should do.
Amen. Yeah.
It drives me batshit crazy.
Do
when
less.
I see like large organizations just blowing their money.
Having seen people work on shoestring budgets and create
art
at the highest level, I just don't really have any patience for that.
I have no patience for it. If you're charging me enough money where I could, if that money could be a substantial part of my student loan payment, the ticket price, I'm not going to go.
As an audience member, I'm willing to come and see something that's a little more sparse if it means that your organization is going to be around for
And if
as
it
long
means
it,
that I can afford to go.
I
mean, like, if I know that your ticket price is so high because you needed that crushed velvet suit, mm-hmm. then fuck that suit. You can't afford that suit.
Right. It's like, not worth
if
it.
You need to hike up, if you mm-hmm. need to...
Hello, Moody.
If you need to gut your audience, then you can't afford whatever you're trying to get.
Mm-hmm. Not only that, but tickets honestly never cover your costs. It's always a bonus. If you're running a smart organization, you know, and I say this as somebody who we ran into some pretty epic financial problems, and now we're raising money to pay for them. But, you know, if you're producing an opera where mm-hmm. you're paying your singers, you're paying your orchestra, your musicians, you're paying your staff, your tickets really shouldn't factor into anything. That should be icing. Mm-hmm. So you mm-hmm. do run into the problem yeah. where...
Well, I'm also... And I would love for that to... I understand that isn't possible, especially for a lot of small organizations. But mm-hmm. ticket sales...
Got Moody all up in here.
Yeah, you don't count the ticket sales until later, and then suddenly that's just your starting level of capital for your yeah. next project. Ticket sales do not factor into the budget for your current project.
Mm-hmm. No.
Ever. Never. Because you're always going to...
And it's just...
By some miracle, sometimes you sell shows well, but...
Yeah.
But not always.
It just isn't
reliable. I feel kind of personally excluded from some of the small, like when I see some of the smaller companies doing shows where the tickets cost more than like $30,
mm-hmm.
you know, if it comes down to paying off my credit cards a little bit faster or going to go see this show for $40 for a ticket, I'm probably going to mm-hmm. pay off my credit cards because it's just like, I got to look out for me.
Yeah.
And I want to go. I want to support my friends. I want to see what they're doing.
And that's the thing, is that it kills me every time that I see that one of my friends is in a show where it's going to cost me $40. And then also you have to factor in fucking getting there.
Yeah.
And like, you know, so like, all told, I can't, it kills me that I have to choose between supporting my friend and not spending $100 in a night.
Mm-hmm.
Correct me if I'm wrong here, but I also sometimes get the impression that arts organizations see young artists as kind of an illegitimate part of their audience, where they're like, well, our goal is not to be only attracting artists. Like, you do a performance and, like, the audience is 75% artists, and you're disappointed because you're not reaching people who aren't artists.
My eye roll was so big it hurt.
But does am I wrong?
No, I
think that you are right in that statement.
And I think that is a mistake.
Yeah.
Because artists, I want to see everyone's shows.
Yep.
I want to see them. I will give you money for them, but I don't have unlimited money.
Well, and here's the thing. That's why, and I'm going to briefly bring up what we're doing, only in that I want to just, like, tout our model for mm-hmm. all of our performances are pay what you can. Like, we're going to have a basket where you can throw in literally loose change if you have it. Like,
hey, laundry money.
I know, right? And at some point we're going to make some kind of announcement like, hey, please, if you're able to donate, we would love it. You know, if you have cash, then cash would be awesome. If you don't have cash, we accept on PayPal. If you don't have anything, that's fine. Thank you so much for coming.
Share this event with your friends. Yeah.
This is kind of a long circle, but this is another way that I think CFAC actually makes a financial difference for arts organizations, is that if it costs less to be an artist, those artists will give their money
right
to mm-hmm. people to see their shows.
Yes.
Yeah. If you know.
I also think, and I always love the ticket price conversation, but I also think there's something to be said about economy of time. It's something I've been thinking about a lot.
Yes.
Where I think a lot of arts organizations don't think about the fact that if you have a show that only runs even 2 weeks, even let's say the generous 2 weeks of maybe 4 or 5 performances, there's a good chance I'm not going to be available for those things because I am working to pay my rent.
Yeah.
And I think that is a mm-hmm. big... And so I think that's the other... And again, I don't know why... I don't mean to, like, bring up our thing, but, like, that's the main reason why we're, like, quantity. Like, if we're doing fucking 2 concerts a week for 3 months. Like, yeah. I don't care. You can't tell me that you can't come to one of them.
Yeah, that was actually something when I saw your post. I was like, well, we have Little Women through June 17th, so I literally am chained to this opera until then. Mm-hmm. But after that, I can start coming to stuff because there's a variety of choices.
Right.
That is nice. I know that some organizations can't do it when they're paying daily or weekly. Weekly is worse for theater rentals.
Oh, yeah. Right.
No, I mean, that's, I mean, we're in a bar and we're in a cafe.
Yeah.
And
well, that's a major advantage.
And that's the rentals. Fucking suck.
As we are learning this year.
I now know every single person in the city who rents space in case need space.
So our you're in our rehearsal space right now. We're putting on the Four Seasons with like this amazing group of like generous, giving, magical string players. And they're coming to our apartment next Wednesday, like from 11 to 1, and they're gonna run shit just here, and we're gonna make food. Like, so like speaking to room rentals, can't even do that.
Yeah. We couldn't either until we had to.
Yeah, exactly.
We figured it out. I mean, that's again part of running an organization is you get crafty real fast.
Yeah.
Well, so here's my kind of my next question on this topic of one of the things that you mentioned was how important it is to work with a shoestring budget, and learning to work with less, which I think is crucial to arts organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is learning to work with less and not, you know, fucking blowing a $6 million donation on turntables or something. Think of anybody off the top of my head.
Going to snore through a turntable show.
Yeah. But so I think that...
What are you talking about? They're turning. How can you sleep through that? It's madness.
I can't look away.
Yeah.
They're turning.
I'm sorry, please continue.
No.
Please finish your question.
And I think
we got a moment.
No, I'm good.
Everyone of us has harassed you now.
I've worked pretty hard on learning how to keep my thread going.
Yeah.
What I think, though, is working on a small budget ends up becoming a balancing game for fledgling, let's say, 2 or 3 years into an arts organization, let's say, figuring out how to sustain.
Mm-hmm.
I think, basically, I want to know your thoughts on that. Like, and I think that, obviously, there are, like, things that you're doing practically that are trials to that end. But I'm curious to just hear more about that.
Well, I think the first thing I would say is that you have to, if your goal is to break even, you need to budget for a surplus.
Mm-hmm. You have to budget such that if the way we look at things is if one or two people don't pay, will we be okay? Mm-hmm. Can we actually run this class if one or two people who are signed up just don't pay?
Mm-hmm.
Because invariably that happens.
Right.
Like, probably 6 out of 10 times that happens where somebody, for various reasons, either they forgot, didn't put it on their calendar, just decided they don't want to do it anymore, you know, family emergency, like, shit happens. So you really need to be smart about budgeting, and that's something that I think I drive Matt a little nuts with stuff, because he's like, what if we do this? And I'm like, how are you going to pay for it?
No, honestly, I love that. That's literally the question I'm asking. I'm like, what if we did this? And my question is, how could we pay to do this?
If you want to operate at cost, if you want to operate at least at cost, you have to anticipate that you're going to lose money in somewhere in the process.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to take more than you have.
So I have a question about your running of a young artist program, specifically a pay to sing. So a big discussion that singers have about young artist programs and pay to sings is, you know, where is that money going? Like, how is that money being spent? Why do I what am I actually paying for? And I'm just wondering what your take on it, having been part of the giving money to process, and now that you're part of the accepting money process.
Yeah. Totally. Well, I'm going to preface all this by saying I have never done a pay to sing. I refuse. I will not.
Good for you.
I have.
I will not. And I just can't fathom spending that kind of money. I've been supporting myself basically since I was 18 financially.
So you literally didn't have it.
I just didn't have it. I had $5,000
in
college.
Yeah.
Yeah, I worked three jobs in college.
Yeah.
And I work full-time now. Like, I can't quit my job to go do a pay-to-sing. But from having watched it and having, you know, heard, having talked to people who've done them, have run them, have been in administrative side, depending on the pay-to-sing, there are some out there that are incredible programs that are run by people who are very ethical and who are run by people who really care. There are those out there. But a lot of those costs go to subsidizing other parts of the program.
I noticed while we were budgeting for this that just a couple other expenses, if we had chosen to do them, would have brought our costs up to a comparable level of these other pay-to-sings.
Yeah.
If we had rented a theater, for example, or if we had...
if we'd done anything involving an orchestra...
Oh my God, yeah, an orchestra. If we had to cover people's housing costs, faculty housing costs, for example, it really quickly gets up to charging people a couple thousand dollars.
It does. It adds up very quickly. And so when young singers are paying into a pay-to-sing program, you're not paying just for your training. You're not paying just for the chance to do the role. You're paying for yoga classes. You're paying to house the yoga instructor. You're paying for someone to come in and talk to you about how to be an entrepreneur. You're paying for the orchestra. You're paying for the electricity to run the lights in the theater. Mm-hmm. You're paying for them dry cleaning the curtains when they're done.
Exactly.
Like, you're paying for all of this overhead that's just mounting and mounting and mounting. And then you end up with these programs that can cost $6,000, $7,000 to do.
Mm-hmm. So they could be run by ethical people who just need to balance their budget. And they say, well, some people
will
pay
to get
do it. If people have the money. And people go to these programs and get good training.
Mm-hmm.
They do. But
there are, like I said, there are some that give you exceptional training that are wonderful, but they're balancing their budget off the backs of singers because they have to.
Because it's the only way. It's the easiest.
Well, and what's unfortunate is that the structure of like how to become Renee Fleming, for instance, starts like the well-regarded, like well-traveled, teacher-touted, university-touted track. Is you start by shelling out thousands upon thousands of dollars, and then you slowly, and then after maybe two of those, you then move up to the level where
it's like a decade
of
just paying.
Well, except that Nene never did a pay to sing because that generation didn't have to do this shit.
Oh, of course.
They did a competition, won it, and got to be famous. Like,
but I'm saying, like, in
they
the
were
last,
like Titus Andromedon.
Eight.
It's like, I want to be famous, on TV. Like,
I mean, like, but that's what I'm saying is, like, the process now, like, any teacher now will tell you. Whereas Renee Fleming, she just
appears.
She just fucking, she killed it at Eastman, and then all of a sudden...
Did the Met National Council auditions and was fully booked.
Like, exactly. Here's what I'll tell you about that process, is the people who have the money to do it come out very good singers.
Absolutely.
But their parents are loaded.
And what I would contest is that path can work, but
it
smashes however many people who could otherwise be exceptional artists.
We generally don't talk to singers who follow a traditional path of like young artist program after young artist program.
I met one the other day.
I went to school with a handful of them. When I was an undergrad, I would say at least six or seven who were doing that traditional track now.
We interviewed one. His name is... I went to college with him. He's like one of my best friends from college. His name is Peter Scott Drackley. He's currently at Santa Fe.
Mm-hmm.
And he's... I mean, his education was not at all conventional. Like, he ended up not graduating college because he was like, fuck this! And he just like... dove into young artist programs pretty much. But he started out with that, climbing that ladder. And yes, like, absolutely, he is phenomenal and amazing. Mm-hmm. Could he have gotten to that level without that process? Probably, but he decided to work within that structure. And so what I like about what you two are doing is that you are providing the comfortability of that structure, mm-hmm. but without the immense expense.
Mm-hmm.
Without,
that was
like the
very
life,
conscious choice.
Like,
oh,
the
yeah.
life
the,
ruining.
The first
that,
conscious
the
choice.
The first conscious yeah. choice that we made, we sat down and we were like, what if we did a summer program that did not cost you an arm and a leg, didn't require you to quit your job, and would help you to make connections within the city?
Yeah.
That was literally mm-hmm. what we sat down and we were like, let's
yeah.
put on a show.
We were like, what's the value of a summer program as far as, like, what do people want to get out of it?
Mm-hmm.
They want to work with excellent teachers and become better.
They want a role.
They want to do roles to put on their resume, and they want to make connections that will turn into work later on.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were like, done. That's all we're going to do. That is all we're going to do, is get a role on your resume, hire the best faculty who we can, and hire people who might be sitting behind a casting desk considering giving you money next year.
Mm. But Matt, what about yoga?
You can do yoga. You can still do yoga.
Yoga.
You're in Chicago.
I'm sorry.
Find yoga, right?
I am not a flexible individual. I'm a person who looks like a... I look like a seal in a sausage casing when I'm doing yoga. Like, it's just not something that my body does.
That's actually a really interesting image, because seals are slick.
They're slick,
as it is.
But then you just add the casing on top
of
that,
so
and
then
it's like,
doubly reflective.
It's just really bad.
I in no way mean for this transition to be what it's about to be, but we have 5 minutes left.
Okay.
And this, I want to ask you a question that has nothing to do with what we've talked about.
Go forth.
So... Pam is from New York.
Yes, I am.
I am from New York.
For fuck's sake.
And I've had these conversations with Tyler Lee, is also from New York. Tyler Lee,
we're cadre.
Yeah. What is it about New York pizza that is better than all of the pizza?
It's every. I mean, first, let's start from the bottom up. Okay.
Yeah.
It's the crust. The
what
crust
is it about the
is
crust?
Like just doughy enough that
it
bends. Without cracking. Like, it
yeah.
bends without cracking. That's the magic.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sauce is just, like, a really thin layer of delightfulness.
By the way, Matt and I are literally exiting the room right now.
They just don't get it. They don't understand.
No.
The cheese is, like, stretchy cheese. It's kind of cheese that pulls away. And then you just fold it, and you get the well of grease
mm-hmm.
in the middle. If you don't have a river of grease, I don't know what to do with you.
Yeah, so I'm going to shout out again. The pizza show on Munchies is really good. It's, like, a 6-episode series of just, like, pizza things.
Yes.
And there's... So, it's... For me, it's about the, like, leoparding on the bottom of a good pie.
Oh,
the, like,
that
when
is
you
so
can
accurate.
Get it. Yeah, when you get it, like, from a good brick oven.
Yeah.
That's, like, very important.
I mean... I understand that people have a very deep and abiding love for deep dish and Chicago-style pizza. I have tried it multiple times. I have been to all of the places that everyone says to
mm-hmm.
go. It's cheesy soup and a dry crust
yeah.
at this point. Like, I just can't eat. I try, and every time I eat it, I feel like I'm dying.
Well, the first time that we got Chicago deep
oh, God.
Dish pizza here,
that was like the sickest
died.
I've ever been.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I
thought I was going to die.
The other day I realized, though, for me, it's partly an authenticity thing, though, because my favorite pizza definitely is Italian pizza, like, and that's such a privileged douchey thing, like, well, I was in Italy for months, and so I actually got to have Italian pizza.
By the way, Matt and I actually did leave the room. We are now back.
We got it.
We got
it. We got now up water.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had to take a moment and
mm-hmm.
have our freak out about pizza.
Mm-hmm.
It actually showed up in my time hop not too long ago.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Our whole, like, Facebook... years-long conversation about pizza.
I've been passionate about it for a really long time. Anyone that follows me on Instagram, I've actually have a thing now where I post my Demos pizza and then I at Joaquim in it, because he's texted me 5 or 6 times being like, let's go to Demos.
You should get Francesco Migliotto on this podcast to talk about real Italian pizza.
Mm.
Yeah, he'll go on about that.
Cool.
I have one final question.
Yes.
And this is... Partially serious, partially a joke. So, aren't you guys... guys, aren't you all excited? We're trying to get better at
gender. I really don't care.
I know, but I do.
I'm from New York. Literally, everybody's like, hey, guys.
Yeah.
It's really hard. Well, sorry. I'm cutting you off.
You are. So, are you all excited for 5 years down the line when you look back at now and you're like, ah, it was so simple back then? Or are you excited for, like, 5 years from now where you're like, you know, look at what we've... Basically, I'm wondering if in 5 years when CVAC and Scoppy are bigger than they are now... Shut up. Bigger than they are now. Are you going to look back at these days and, like, treasure the beginnings? Or are you just going to, like, shudder?
I will be shuddering. I have very, very vivid nightmares about not being able to pay our bills. It's what keeps me up at night.
I don't have an alarm clock set, and I haven't for the last, like, couple of weeks, and it's because in the morning the sun shines on me, and I bolt up in a panic because I haven't been doing enough.
Yeah. I mean, like, I work full-time 8:30 to 5:30 every single day. And then I basically go home and I practice for an hour, and then I do CVAC for like 2 to 3 hours. I mean, when we are fully functional and we have an administrator and a board and people who can handle some of this like minute bullshit so that we can focus on big picture, on planning, on where we want to take this organization at large. If when that day comes, I will be rejoicing.
Yeah, 5 years from now, I'm going to look back and go, ha. Look how hard I was working. Yeah. And then I'm gonna like drink two beers in quick succession.
I'm gonna double fist Palomas. Yeah. Like, that's literally where I'm gonna be. And I'll have the money to do it.
Right. How do you feel about it, Daniel?
I sleep pretty soundly usually. I had a stress nightmare last night. I didn't tell you about this yet. I had a stress nightmare.
But here we are in front of a microphone. Yeah.
Dan thinks it's the perfect time to share personal details.
I had a stress nightmare that one of the violinists was messaging me being like, well, I hate you now. So have fun finding a new violinist for Vivaldi Four Seasons.
Because she hates email?
No.
Hate you now.
I hate me, yeah.
Oh, I thought you said, well, I hate email. And I was like, that's a...
I've met some people who basically do and never respond.
That's true. That is probably a reason.
Have they told you, well, I hate emails, so I'm no longer participating.
That is actually something I would say about managing an organization here where we're in touch with so many different artists, is that my eyes have been opened to a whole world of new and crazy reasons to not respond to emails.
It's very true.
It's really interesting.
People send us emails and like, they're like, oh, I want to pitch this class idea to you. And I'm like, have you ever talked to us before? Because I don't know who you are. I have literally no idea who this email is from.
I don't mind.
I need like a little introduction just to tell me who you are.
Oh, yeah.
Like, hi, my name is so-and-so. I do so-and-so. Sometimes I get like cold Facebook messages from people just being like, you should do this.
That's true. We should have a technical writing class built into our arts degrees. Because Lord knows all I do is technical writing.
Yeah. I mean, we do a lot of it now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I said that like a joke, but I'm serious.
It's serious.
Yeah.
We should do one.
Yeah, someone should hire me. Should hire you to do an artist tax class.
Yeah, and we'll hire you to do technical writing.
Yep. And then we can come on and do media training.
Hot sauce. Yep. We have a whole new line of classes.
Yeah. Nailed it.
So we're founding our fall university.
I'll be cold messaging you about it from the Facebook page I'm going to profile and make tomorrow.
It drives me crazy when I get those messages where I'm like, I just don't know who you are. Like, I see a picture and a name, but I've never met you. Mm-hmm. Who are you? Just introduce yourself to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. Well, we have a couple minutes left. Woo! So it is the thing we do at the end of every episode's time, which is a time for you guys to plug whatever you
that
have.
That was a big eye roll.
No, I'm more frustrated with myself because it's like I should learn this by now. Like I've worked on it now for like a month and a half, and I feel like it's actually a really good thing to do.
This is culturally ingrained. It's gonna be a while.
Well, so here's the thing: if I say "you guys" to you, most of the time it's because you're representing an organization, mm-hmm. and so what I'm saying, or an administration, and so what I'm saying basically is your or administration must all be men.
Except it's so not.
Yeah.
Well, but that's the deeply ingrained cultural thing, yes. is that you refer to a group running an organization as you guys.
Right.
Because this suggestion mm-hmm. would be... So I think that that's why we're trying... Especially because this organization is not run by just guys.
Right.
And so, like, it's not...
You're
very pointed look
that.
From Green.
Well, which, like... which, if it were like, oh, yeah, those guys at Scoppy Magazine, I'd be like...
Well, the thing is, you entirely do all of the incoming messages. Basically, if your email... People email me thinking they're emailing me,
which is
and
the
they're
exact
definitely
opposite
emailing
of
you.
Us.
Newsflash.
Yeah.
Do not... Anyone out there who wants to contact Scoppy Magazine, I do not recommend contacting Daniel.
I send out emails like a motherfucker. I do not receive emails well.
Yeah, see, it's the exact opposite when you're talking to us, because
mm-hmm.
Matt answers almost everything,
mm-hmm.
and I'm back in the corner in the fetal position balancing our checkbook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm like, Pam, do you want to like talk to someone about this? And she's like, no!
I'm crying about money.
No, so... Anyone out there, no. Anyone out there who, you know, wants to reach out to one of us and they're thinking, maybe I'll message Daniel. Mistake.
Talk to Maureen.
Find me on Facebook, Maureen Smith. I check, you know what, the difference between Daniel and I is, in terms of our correspondences, I check my filtered messages.
Wow.
Look at you.
All right, so, plug. So tell us what you have upcoming. You each have a minute to talk about your upcoming events, upcoming things. There's also kind of a, if you feel like you didn't fill up your whole minute, we don't actually time them, so it's not a big deal or anything. But there's also room to talk about, like, self-care, people that are doing dope work.
General art or media that you are consuming.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Well, I guess I'll start. I'm going to plug our upcoming performances of Little Women.
Mm-hmm.
They will be June 16th and 17th at 7 p.m. at Lincoln Park Presbyterian Church. They have been so kind as to house us for our performances. Mm-hmm. Also, big shout out to Unity Lutheran in Edgewater for housing us for our rehearsals, and Roosevelt University for some of our other rehearsals. It's going to be a really exciting project. We are doing this as pretty much as minimalist as possible. It's going to be, you know, the bare minimum for props, some light furniture, and like rehearsal skirts. This is going to be all about the art that we're making, about the chance for this incredible group of young singers to get on their feet and do this role with this amazing faculty. And we're just hoping as much of the community can come as possible. We are not charging for tickets. It will be a free love donation at the door. So, you know, please bring cash, or you can partake in some of our other ways of donating that Matt will talk about.
Which include our Indiegogo campaign and our new Patreon. So, we are hoping by June 16th to raise $2,500. We are just over $500 now, and that money is, it's going to cover a couple of unforeseen costs we had with Little Women. We had to move into a new space, but most of it is going to go towards our fees for becoming officially a nonprofit, and to kind of boost us into that expansion of our infrastructure that we were talking about. This is the right time to give to us, because that money is going to translate into more money for us from different sources,
mm-hmm.
and into a sustainable business model, and into, you know, benefits for, like I was saying earlier, every institution
mm-hmm.
that relies on vocal arts in Chicago.
And 2 years ago, we raised $1,000 that sustained us for 2 years.
We haven't asked for any money since then.
We made that money last.
I promise you, we're good with money. and then, after you make the one-time donation, you can continue to support CDAC without much mental effort on your part by subscribing to our Patreon, where you donate monthly. And you can give as little as $1 a month, and or up to however much you feel like giving us. Our goal is to raise $1,200 a month.
Mm-hmm.
With the Patreon.
Our goal eventually.
To completely fund an administrative position. And if you donate there, you'll also will be uploading photos, videos, testimonials. Mm-hmm. You can see what classes your money is going to, who's benefiting, and what CFAC's up to. So mm-hmm. it's a really great, great way to.
Additionally, in the future, this is probably a little bit down the road. We're looking at doing some events for our Patreon donors to come mm-hmm. in and really see who is benefiting through mm-hmm. performances, through, you know, open workshops, open classes.
Right.
So that one thing that we pride ourselves on is that we are very transparent about how much money we make, about where it goes, and about what we're doing. We pretty much have no secrets, like except our FEIN. That's like the only number that we keep secret. And we're very open about everything. And that's something we really want to do eventually for our Patreon donors.
Yep. I also want to plug the original source material for the Disney movie Bambi. I found it in a thrift store the other day.
For fuck's sake.
It's a book. It's like a very old store? Book.
Very important. Which thrift store?
Green Element.
Nice.
It's a short book. I've been reading it for 2 days. It is devastating. It's so well done. You know, the movie Bambi was, you thought that was heartbreaking? They really watered
Dude,
it down.
Fox
for kids.
And the Hound is the heartbreaking one.
That's all I have to say.
Cool.
And that was a good plug.
That was that's probably me. If you're going to plug that, I'm going to plug some books on Louisa May Alcott for all you guys to really do studying on transcendentalism before you come to Little Women. I highly recommend two books by Susan Cheever. She is a transcendental scholar. One of them is called American Bloomsbury. It covers kind of the whole movement that was happening in Concord at the time, including some badass women like Margaret Fuller. If you don't know who she is, please go look her up. She was incredible. And her other book, which is Louise May Alcott, A Personal Biography. Highly recommend them before coming to Little Women. You'll have a very different experience having learned about her.
Nice.
Cool.
So excited. Come to our show.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for listening. I've been Daniel Johansson.
I continue to be Maureen Smith.
If you want to keep up with what we're up to, there's a lot of ways you can do that. The first being you can head over to our website. That's scopymag.com. You can see all of our articles there. There is a list of our most recent episodes there as well. You also can find us on the regular social media places, Facebook under Scopy Magazine, Instagram and Twitter at Scopy Mag. One of what we have going on right now, we kind of mentioned it a little bit during the show, but actually it's coming up really soon. It's coming up next week. Well, it'll be this week.
It's coming up in 4 days.
Yeah. We are doing our Scopy Sessions performance series. And so what that actually entails is we'll be doing 3 months of performances on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Tuesdays are going to be down in Nightcap. Thursdays are going to be up in Redline Tap in Pilsen and Rogers Park, respectively. So the first thing we're doing is 24 Italian songs and arias concerts. We're performing through the whole book. We finally got all the singers for it, so that's really exciting. Vivaldi Four Seasons is then on Thursday up in Redline Tap. Then the following week, we'll be doing a Rossini songs recital on the Tuesday. On the Thursday, we'll be doing Rossini chamber music paired with a new music premiere by Anthony Barese of the Beata Tweets, followed by the next Tuesday, down in Nightcap, we'll be doing She After, which is a one-act feminist opera, dope as fuck. Emily Cox is going to be singing it. Thursday, Poetry Night up in Redline Tap. And and then the week after that we'll be off, but then we'll come back in July. We'll be announcing all those dates, so keep posted on Facebook to find out more about what we're working on as those months come up.
And as always, I'm here to emphasize the importance of donations. We run on a shoestring budget, as in I got my tax refund and donated $100, and that is now a third of our working budget. So,
real.
So I am currently our biggest donor. So please beat me at that. Please, I would love to be surpassed. So you can do that by going to scopymag.com, go to our about page. That super bummed me out. Go to our about page.
Preach.
There are two ways that you can give. You can give on a monthly basis, for as little as $5 a month. The benefits of that are that you'll get a shout out on the show. You will be invited to any show that we put on in our apartment, which that'll happen in the fall because we can't do any more performances this summer. We can't.
We feel ya.
But, and also we're working on other incentives. You know, every donation that we receive, even from me, means the world. It makes such a big difference. It literally, every $20 that we receive makes all the difference between doing something and not doing something, like an entire event.
Yeah.
So anything that you can give, we will be so, so grateful. Give a little, give a lot. And if you can't give, which, understandable, listen, participate, and share.
Yeah, I'm going to plug again. If you can't give, one of the biggest things that would be really helpful right now is head over to Facebook, attend, mark that you're, even if you can't come, mark that you're attending on our events. That would be a huge deal. And share our events, like our posts, because fucking the Facebook algorithm. I complain about Mark Zuckerberg too much on this show. So they know. They know.
I figured it out. I can now target 5 million people with a post.
Oh, yeah. We'll talk about that after the show. Okay. Thank you all so much for listening. Go out and make something.
Yes.